Let's get corrupted. What is going on, everybody? It's your boy Joe with Meteoric Serpents coming back at you for another episode of the Colubrid Corruption Podcast. Guys, always happy to be back for another episode. I know I did not announce this one in advance, and I do apologize for that. But anyone here listening live and listening to the replay, as always, I appreciate you. This is going to be a super good one. As you saw, if you're watching the thumbnail for tonight, we do have on John Rice from Fathom Hogs. Going to be a great episode. He gave a really informative talk at Colubrid Fest. He's working on the Hognose book with Dr. Loafman. So we got a lot to talk about, along with the, as the title of the podcast shows, the wonderful world of Hognoses. As you guys know, I mean, they're the hottest Colubrid out there. There's no lie about that. And just so much to go over in terms of genetics and just the different animals out there and line breeding and all that stuff. And I know I've had a few Hognose guests on, but I'm always curious to hear the perspective of different people when they're working the same field and there's so many avenues and ways to go about it. So this is going to be a good one, guys. And also, I just vended a show all weekend, so I am tired, but I'm always alert and ready to do these episodes. So it's going to be a good one. Had a good time at the show this weekend, the Scales Expo in West Palm Beach. It was cool. I sold just a couple snakes, but I sold someone their first snake ever, which was a Texas rat snake. And I just put that on my Instagram story. And that's a real cool full circle moment for me because my first snake was a Texas rat. So just super, super cool to do that for someone else. They texted me afterwards or just a few minutes ago and thanked me for it and all that. So really awesome. And with that said, one thing I do bring to the expos are these awesome t-shirts, the brand new Let's Get Corrupted Colubrid Corruption t-shirts. Those and my logo shirts I have available on hand. So if anyone is interested in those, don't hesitate to contact me and I'd be happy to get those out to you. Shane's in the chat. Shane, if you're listening, I have the shirt for your son. I didn't text you because I kind of wanted to surprise you, but I have the shirt for your son. So if you're still here, yeah, that's what's up. And guys, if you're listening to this and you enjoy the show, please make sure you hit the like button on today's video. Make sure to hit the subscribe button on YouTube. And if you're listening on the audio platforms, which we're on, the major ones like Apple, Spotify, come over to YouTube, hit the subscribe button, hit the like button. Really helps us out. Spreads the word out there to more people, and then leave a rate and review it on those platforms as well. And then, as you guys can see, and you probably all know, you can find me at Meteoric Serpents on pretty much all major social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, obviously YouTube. You can find me on Morph Market and the Show Me Marketplace, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. Guys, make sure you're supporting USARC, USARC Florida, the organizations that fight for our rights to keep our reptiles. Want to make sure we're fighting against legislation that can possibly take those animals away. Guys, if you go to the first link in the description below, you will get the link to the Meteoric Serpents Patreon, which is an awesome way. One, you can just, you know, that's a way to support me, say thanks for the show, all that. But it's also a group chat of all fellow Colubrid enthusiast people who are excited about these animals in the hobby. A good way to network and learn from other people. Because I think that's the best way to do that is just connecting with other people and doing all that stuff. So if you're interested, hit that link. If you want, ask me about it. Feel free. Then guys, below that, you will also see, the sponsor of the podcast is the Show Me Reptiles show and the Show Me Marketplace. Like I've said, it was great to meet Mickey at Colubrid Fest. He did a hell of a job putting that out. They do shows all over the country. So wherever you're at, go check out and see if there's a Show Me Reptiles show near you. And I almost bet there is. And guys, the hashtag Colubrid Corruption of the week, and he's in the chat today from Mr. Oh, wait, I have to share my screen. That would be nice. Let's see. There we go. from Jason Keller himself. He just posted this too. The Egyptian diadem rat snake. Cool one, an interesting species you don't see all too often. He's got a 2.3 of the group, but he just posted this reel and it popped up on the hashtag feed. So I thought, why not show those off? Yeah, so shout out Jason Keller. Go follow him, King_Baboon1. And yeah, check out his snakes. He's got some cool stuff. But yeah, guys, let's see. And before we get started, just a quick hello to the chat. Shane is there. I don't think he heard the message about his son's shirt, but that's okay. Shane, I'll send you a message and I'll get that out to you. Adam from Ivory Kaluber Co., one of the Patreon members. What's up, my man? Yes, sir. Hope you're doing well, too, you and your family. Then Jason Keller, like I said, he's here as well. But yeah, guys. All right, let's get this started and let's bring out our guest for tonight. We have Mr. John Rice of Fathom Hogs. What's up, man?
What's up, Joe? Thanks for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Now, like I kind of said during, you know, when I was introducing you a little bit, we definitely have a lot to talk about. But before we even get into all of that, I'd like to always ask everyone, where did this hobby start for you? And how did that kind of segue into where you are today with it?
Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, for me, I started at an early age. I grew up in the outskirts in Ohio in the country. And I always had a fascination with dinosaurs. I think a lot of us reptile people, you know, it always starts with dinosaurs when we're very young. But when I was growing up, my neighbor, you know, they were the only ones that had kids around my age that were up the hill from us. His dad kept a large collection of snakes. So I got introduced to actual snakes from those guys at a very early age. I would say probably 7-8 years old. I was out there finding snakes. You know, I'd go out with the father and his sons, and we'd go snake hunting and catch lots of garter snakes, water snakes, an occasional black snake, eastern milk snakes from the locations we're at in Ohio. And I just, you know, begun to, you know, get a big fascination with them at that. I started breeding my first snakes when I was 11 years old.
Hell yeah. My
first ones, and they were some of the same ones that a lot of people do. I, you know, heard you speak about the Texas rat snakes. Mine were Emory rat snakes.
Okay, awesome.
Very, very similar locale for sure.
Yep.
And bred those and corn snakes and just was fascinated by everything around them. You know, I would save up all my allowance and cut grass, you know, for people and things, and save up every penny that I could just to go to the Columbus Reptile Show, which is one of the first ones I guess was awesome. In the country. Didn't know that. Don Hamper started that show, and you know, I would go save up over a couple months, you know, $200 or something, $300, and just go blow it all on snakes, you know, to have fun with. So yeah,
that's a great story, man. I mean, 11 years old breeding your first snakes, there aren't many people who could say that. Like, were you getting help from your parents, or were you legitimately doing everything like kind of on your own?
It was all me.
That's awesome.
I didn't, you know, back then, you know, we had to read books. You know, there wasn't really the internet. You know, I'm part of the group, you know, that got to experience the first of the internet and everything. So,
okay,
I would say that was, 93 when I bred my first snakes. And, you just read books. And, you know, I got a lot of tips from my friend's father that kept a lot of species. He didn't ever breed his snakes, but he had a lot of experience on just keeping them thriving. So I just kind of followed that and then, you know, began breeding them.
Awesome. Yeah. You know, people say like, you know, hatching eggs makes you feel like a kid again, but you really got, I mean, you did it when you were a kid. So, I mean, that's just amazing. I know I bred my first ones at, I think I was like 16 years old, and I was working at a pet store too, where I was very hands-on with breeding. So it was always such a cool experience being able to do it from, you know, that early age.
Oh yeah. No, it was rewarding. You know, I was always known as the kid. You know, I did not. I know a lot of people, especially back then. You know, it wasn't as popular as it is today. I know right. you spoke about that. You know, at the Kluber Fest.
Yeah, I did.
Where you, you know, it was more of everyone was fascinated. You know, with that, and you know, back when I was doing it, and I was at that young age, it was still taboo. But I was very open about it. You know, right. I would tell, you know, all my friends would want to come over and see my snake collection and and was just fascinated by the snake. So I was very, you know, I was very eager to spread the word about that and to teach. And that was always something that I was passionate about, was to show people that they're not scary. They're not, you know, something, you know, that you have to worry. You know, being from Ohio, you know, I would go out and do snake removals with some people. I would always have, you know, hey, it's a copperhead in our basement, or, you know, it's a water moccasin out in our pond. You know, we don't have water moccasins or cottonmouths in Ohio. So you already knew. And it was a good spot for education, you know, to teach people that, you know, it's OK that they're there and they're not dangerous to you or any of the other animals, you know, like your family pets. So,
yeah. Cool. And then, so, you know, you started all the way back then, and then how did that collection build up, and how did that bring you to where you are today? I mean, you know, you and your partner, Mitch, I mean, Fathom Hogs is probably one of the more common names I hear in the hognose industry. You guys have made a pretty big name and reputation for yourselves. So how did you get all the way to here?
I mean, it's a long process for sure. You know, back when I started breeding hognose snakes, well, even keeping them, I would say it's been about 12 years that I've been keeping them. But they weren't the cool species back then. I mean, it's more of a new thing, you know, over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years that, you know, hognose snakes have become so popular, you know, in captive husbandry, and everything's come a long way in that amount of time. A lot of information's come out there. You know, I like to hope that I help deliver some of that information to the public, but, you know, I'm always very open about it. But just starting out, you know, I went to Ohio State, and I was majoring in biology, minoring in herpetology. I was a dropout. I dropped out of college.
Okay.
I went there, lots of really good information, you know, was in the college programs, but the math wasn't mathing for me. I was looking at, you know, what type of degree I could get in that amount of time. And I was always a numbers guy. So I was looking at how much I would be in debt versus what I would be making working for an institution like the Columbus Zoo.
Smart way to look at it.
Yeah, I did, you know, and it was tough for me to walk away. And, you know, one thing I got to give, you know, Zach, he does that program down there at West Liberty, and he's just amazing with the students down there. And if I had a teacher like him, I probably would have never left school. But I didn't see the benefit of going to school, and I had more aspirations in life. I wanted more out of that. So I went into a management career for a long time and just focused on the snakes as a side and started building a brand from there. First I did boa constrictors for quite a long time, but then got into the hognose snakes.
Gotcha.
And we started Fathom Hogs, Mitch and I, about 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago now. He was the one that thought of the name Fathom Hogs. I hated it. I am not going to lie. I hated it. I was like, man, I just don't know about that name. It doesn't click for me. And, you know, but I was like, all right, screw it. Let's run with it. And, and that's what we started. And we just focused, you know, for the first few years on just outcrossing, breeding, bringing in new blood, working on thinking 4 years ahead on everything that we do. You know, I think that was important there, and we just built this brand, and it's turned into a beautiful thing.
That's awesome.
I'm just amazed at where this business has went, and you know, I'm just real proud of everything that we've achieved.
Yeah, man, definitely. You brought up a lot of talking points in there, so I'm gonna kind of go one by one.
Sure.
And we'll go there. first off, to kind of compliment what you said about school, like biology, herpetology, what's interesting, and I wanted to ask about this because the way you gave your talk at Colubrid Fest, it seemed like you had a very sciencey way of talking and going about it, and also complimenting with the fact that you're helping to write the book with Zach. I kind of like figured that you maybe had some sort of science background, you know, it in school or whatever. So that was interesting to hear. And then secondly, how did you and Mitch actually link up? Because he's down here in Florida by me, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Mitch was a customer. He came to me and I had, I'd produced some of the world's, they were Arctic Het Lavenders. I can't even remember how many years ago I produced those, but they were Arctic Het Lavenders. And he approached me. He had heard through, you know, some of our other mutual friends that at that point in time that I had them, and he approached me, and, you know, it was one of my first big sales, honestly. You know, back when I first started breeding hognose snakes and selling them, I would be, you know, excited, you know, if I made like $700 on a group of babies that I wholesaled to, right, you know, a retailer, and I wouldn't have to pay for mice out of my pocket, you know. Yep. or I could go buy a new, you know, a new vision rack back before they got bought out and they were much more inexpensive than they are now. I would, you know, go buy a new rack when I sold a couple snakes. Well, he was the first one. I want to say it was like, I don't know, like $2,000 or $3,000 that I charged him for that snake.
Okay.
And, you know, I was excited. I was like, oh my gosh, this guy didn't even bat an eye at, you know, at getting a snake off me. I'm going to be able to do this and that. And we, you know, obviously as a customer, he asked a lot of questions and we talked a lot about, you know, perspective, how I'm breeding and how I'm doing things. And, you know, we became great friends. And one day we were talking, he had a nice reptile, a nice hognose snake collection. And I had one, and he's like, hey man, like, what if we joined forces and like really propelled our projects forward with some of the stuff that I have and some of the stuff that he has. And, that's what we did.
And yeah.
We went down to Florida, to the Daytona show. We made our first Fathom Hog shirts, and we just walked around and we passed out business cards.
Awesome.
And, you know, everyone looked at us, you know, like, who are these guys? You know, it was exciting with those first steps there. So
cool.
Yeah. Cool.
And then another point, I'm sorry to keep backtracking. Another one that you brought up, because I had Jeff on the show a couple months back. And, you know, he mentioned he got into hogs, you know, at an early time before that popularity really happened, you know, similar to you 12 years ago. I mean, I didn't really know about hog noses, but like, or I was still a little kid back then. But either way, you know, what was it for you that you were like, okay, let's do these hog nose snakes and start working on these? And what was really that kind of drive there?
You know, I wanted to do something that was different. You know, I'd bred a lot of rat snakes. I'd bred a lot of king snakes and some milk snakes. I bred boas for years. And I wanted, you know, I had had Western hognose snakes when I was very young, you know, just as from a husbandry standpoint, just keeping them. They were fun for me. And yeah. I would say I had my first ones that I actually kept. You know, I was probably 15 years old, 14 years old. So we're talking, I don't know, 25 years ago, 26 years ago. I had, you know, my first Westerns, and I thought they were a very interesting species back then. Back then, when I first started getting into snakes, I'd go out and get babies, you know, baby corn snake, Texas rat snake, whatever it was, Western hognose snake. I'd raise them to be adults, and then I would trade them for babies. You know, it was something that it was just fun to me, just the experience with different species more than anything. So, you know, that's what brought me back to them. You know, I love the look of them. I love that they almost mimic like a prairie rattlesnake. They have the very heavily keeled scales, and they're different. You know, they've got the upturned rostral scale, and, you know, it's a very... You know, a lot of people can, you know, say group snakes together and be like, these are king snakes or milk snakes or rat snakes. And they all have similar, they're very similar in body shape. Yes. the hognose snake is just the one that got thrown the curveball. And, you know, the Eastern, you know, is a much bigger, obviously. But I really like, you know, the ease and care of the Westerns, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, it just makes them a more ideal animal in a captive husbandry setting.
100%. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, I mean, back then when you were getting into it, I'm sure you couldn't possibly predict the craze and the amount of morphs and line breeding that there is today.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Like, when I first started breeding them, you know, there wasn't much out. I want to say there was like Evans Hypo, T negative albino, you know, Anaconda was just out, you know, it was something new. I remember when it first came out and the popularity of it. And then, you know, Arctic came along and really forced everything in front, you know, but yeah, just lots of exciting and contrasting color mutations that really, really gave you the opportunity to move forward with a lot of projects. You know, Sable's one of them as well with the hypermelanin gene. You know, I think it really made a lot of things more popular. Arctic and Sable, I would say, were the two ones. Anaconda, obviously, everyone loves super anacondas, the patternless snakes.
Right.
I'm not a huge fan of them, but a lot of people are. But I think Arctic and Sable were the two that really pushed that group of animals forward. It just showed people amazing things. Super Arctic, you know, it's just an amazing animal, the black and whites, and yeah.
Awesome. And then when it comes to the morphs and mutations and stuff you've created, you know, you even mentioned a world's first, and I know Zach has mentioned that, you know, some of the genes and stuff you're going to be writing about in that section of the book, you created, or it came out of your collection at least. Is that true?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I produce on average. I don't know. I don't really keep count of like world's first, but I don't know, at least one to four or five a year. You know, I produce world first color combinations. Some years have been more, some years have been less, but it's always exciting, you know, to see and to see, you know, hognose snakes are just finally, you know, for years, you know, you would either hatch like a head albino to an albino and get half albinos, or, you know, head to heads and get stuff like that. Now it's almost like corn snakes where, you know, you breed a group of animals together and you get a kaleidoscope of colors that come out of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's super exciting to see that. And, you know, it gives you the opportunity to make some of these first color combinations, you know, the first time people have seen them. And it's just amazing. You never know what these different alleles will do with each other and what you unlock, you know, when you breed these animals together.
Right. And then any morphs or line bred traits that started with you in your collection?
So specific morphs, I've got two of them that I'm playing around with. I have one that I've, you know, I can't really call it something too crazy. It's more of like a dominant gene. I'm calling it cantaloupe. That I'm playing around with it. It has a very high contrasting pattern, zero pattern on the head of the animal. There's no super form. I was looking to see, it was acting like a incomplete dominant, but it's more of just a dominant gene, in my opinion, unless it's acting kind of like a pinstripe in ball pythons, where the super form of a pinstripe is, you know, looks identical to the normal color of a pinstripe. So it could be acting like that. Not really. I haven't really got that far. All I've got is, you know, this first generations of back crossings going back into each other to really understand it. But I have bred F2 males and been getting the same results as I have from the original male that I brought into to see how this gene is working. I have that one, and then I have one I'm calling a red dragon. It popped up randomly about 3 years ago out of my collection, but I haven't proven it yet.
Okay.
So it's still something that's just sitting idle. It came out of albino Arctic to albino conda breeding, and this thing just looks incredible. I mean, I don't know what it is. A lot of people are saying it's more like a cinnamon gene, maybe like an albino cinnamon, but I'm going to see. I'm, you know, time will tell, you know, with all this stuff. It's just, you know, breeding trials. You know, with having the access with like RGI doing what they're doing with the sequencing of the hognose snake genes to really understand them better, that will help. You know, especially with some of these other genes, but just to understand what's happening there. So
yeah, it is. It's definitely cool that RGI is looking to expand into the colubrid circle. And definitely hognose and corn snakes are the two main culprits, especially being the most genetically diverse or the most gene packed animals that we probably have in the trade for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Cool. And then, you know, I always like if someone's listening to this for the first time and doesn't really know the Hognose 101, can you kind of give an overview of general husbandry? What are some of your practices and you know, stuff like that?
Sure. Yeah. General husbandry of hognose snakes. You know, I like to keep anything that's, you know, a year of age and under in something like a 6-quart container. You know, about that type of square footage. I use FB5s for a lot of my stuff in the commercial line of things, but a 6-quart, you know, in that amount of space, just to get them up and going and comfortable in their environment. I try to do everything basic, man. I, you know, I'll have a basic water bowl. I use sandy chips, coarse sandy chips, which is a fine aspen bedding. It's probably, I don't know. What do you think? Like 2 millimeter by 2 millimeter chip, essentially.
Yeah, they're very, very tiny little. Yeah. If anyone's watching, they're literally like this big each. Yeah. Like barely anything. Super thin.
Yeah, but I like those. You know, you can use shredded aspen. I think the hognose snakes like the shredded a little bit more because it gives them burrowing opportunities. Gotcha. Whereas the sandy chips don't hold a burrow because these are definitely burrowing animals. But yep. So I keep them in a 6-quart. I use those coarse sandy chips in there, a water bowl, a hide, and a moist hide. I think with the basic and with them, the better. It really gives you an opportunity to focus on the health of the snake instead of giving it a bunch of decorations. As it begins to thrive and get bigger, you can go elaborate as you want to get. You know, you know, some of these guys that I've sold some of the hognose snakes to, they have amazing cages. I had one customer; he's actually a fighter pilot for the U.S. Navy.
Oh wow!
He or Air Force, I should say. He spent 1 year doing a 36 by 2 foot by 2 foot cage, planting it, putting a whole like scene in there with a spineless cactuses, everything like that, a burrow going underneath that he spent a year growing everything in here before he actually acquired the hognose snake from me.
And
I thought that was just amazing that he spent that much time. But you know, I think with these guys, basic is better, and that moist hide really helps them out a lot. You know, these guys are very, you know, they burrow a lot. So when they're in the ground, they're exposed to that humidity. It may be 110 degrees on the surface, but you get 6 inches underground, that temperature drops dramatically.
Yep.
And with those guys spending so much time in the ground, just having that moist place for them to go, you see them go in there a lot. So it's something. It's one thing, you know, I know a lot of keepers talk about watch your animals, you know, watch what they're doing. Are they going to the hot spot? Are they staying on the cool side? You know, that's one of the things you got to look at. And, for temperature wise, I like to do 72 to 76 degrees ambient temperature, and then a hot spot of about 88.
Okay.
Some people go hotter. I feel like, it smokes the animals sometimes.
Yeah.
It really puts their metabolism real high. And you know, sometimes they have a hard time with that. So.
Yeah. And I know they could be found pretty far south, but I've always found it very interesting because that type of mid to high 80s temperature has been consistent with every hognose person I've talked to. And I've always just found it very, because I've never, like, even with the Texas rats, like, I've never gone that warm. But obviously, I mean, you guys are breeding them with ease. So clearly, you know, they like and can take that heat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do. But they do like it cool as well. You know, they like that. They like that gradient to be able to get away.
Right.
I only see them a lot of times when I'm watching the animals after I feed them. They'll go back there and sit on that hot spot for like a day or two after that,
kind of digest.
They're done. Yeah, they're gotcha. Getting down. They're cooling off. They're getting away from that heat. They'll be stuck at the front of the tub, you know, away from the heat after that. And it's funny. They all act the same way. You feed them, they go back here, hang out for a day or two, then they're right back in the front. And their digestive system, not saying it's as fast as like dry Marcon, like an indigo snake, but pretty close. You know, you feed them and 3 days later, you're going to have a pile there to deal with. So, you know, it's something that, you know, it's something that I take a lot of pride in and staying on top of cleanliness inside the facility. But it's, you know, they can be stinky little guys. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. You know, another thing I noticed with like the guys who do really a lot of hog noses big time, like you, it seems like you have a very large collection, and not that I'm asking for numbers, and I'm sure you may not even know the numbers, but like on a typical season nowadays, like how many clutches do you like expect per year or like shoot for?
I don't like to produce a lot of hognose snakes.
Okay.
You know, in years past, you know, I've produced 800 to 1,000 a year babies. You know, this year I wanted to produce about 550. That was my goal. I ended up with about 745. yeah, unfortunately. And it's funny, like I know a lot of people have called me crazy. Last 10 clutches of the year. All right. They were nice clutches, but I had gotten everything. I don't breed for the market. I mean, I do, you know, there's always a demand. I breed for snakes for other breeders to get and things like that. But I'm not like focusing on like, all right, I want to make as many sunbursts as possible to feed the market. Right. I make enough for me. And then the byproduct can go to my friends, other breeders and things like that. So I focus on projects for myself. And I had gotten all the eggs this year for the projects that I wanted. So the last 10 clutches of eggs I got this year, I literally fed them back to the female hognose snakes because they love snake eggs. But I was done. Yeah. I was like, I don't want any more baby hognose snakes. I don't need any more, especially with the gene combinations that I was working with. So I just fed them the eggs, you know, to get a nice nutrient boost back to them. And
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it is what it is. But I would say on average, I like to produce anywhere between, we'll call it 500 and 700 babies a year. I feel comfortable with that. Okay. And then breeders, I probably have about maybe 200 males and females. Yeah, right around there. Yeah, I don't breed everything every year, but
yeah, I'm sure.
You know, yeah.
Okay. Cool. And, you know, when it comes to your collection, just because, you know, there's a ton of morphs out there, but like, what's some of your favorite stuff? What's your, even right now, like what's your go-to project, or does that really just depend? I mean, I'm sure you have stuff all over the place when it comes to the genes.
Yeah, I do have two projects, that I'm real excited about. Actually. I'm working on super Arctic lavender storm clouds.
Okay.
This year I struck out. I didn't get any of the visuals. I hit everything around it. I hit storm clouds. I hit sable lavenders, Arctic versions of everything. But I didn't get the triple visual. What my goal is to try and make a true blue snake. And, you know, storm cloud gets you there. It's more of like a,
right.
You know, it is a bluish snake.
It's a grayscale. I know what they look like.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I made some real pretty ones of those this year, some super conda Arctic storm clouds and, a few other things, but I want to make a real blue snake. And I think adding lavender into it with super Arctic, with what super Arctic does with the sable gene already, you get a lot of, blues and different hues that pop through with it, with the super Arctic sable. So that's my goal there. And then I am also working on, lavender toffee sables. So I made some hets this year with some of my super Arctic Mai Tais that I had made a few years ago, and I made some hets for that stuff. So just excited to see those two right there. But still, my personal favorite color combination, super Arctics. I love
them.
I think the black and white with those guys is just an incredible animal. Jeff did a great job. with that gene. I mean, you know, it is what it is with the gene, but he definitely, that is one of the, that's my favorite gene on the market for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. And from what I know, I talked to Alvaro quite a bit. It's kind of like an enhancing gene as well, right? Like it kind of just helps any combo that it's in.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It takes away and helps. So it just depends. You know, you don't know until you know with those. So it's something that I've bred. Like I have some red line Mai Tais that I've been working on for a few years, and I make Arctic versions of those. Makes them suck, you know. Okay. So it's better not having that gene in that color combination. But it does some amazing things, like with toffee. Toffee belly is a pretty common gene out there, but when you make super Arctic toffees, they go from this like orange looking snake to a purple snake, and it's just amazing how the alleles set with those two specific morphs in the hognose snake, and how it changes that color that drastically.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pull up your Instagram just so we can kind of scroll through some things. There's so many hogs. It's just, it's almost hard. And guys, I have the link to John's Instagram in the description at shovelnose82. Yeah, I mean, you just scroll through and see a bunch of really cool looking hognose. So many babies. If you see something you want to point out, stop me. But
right there, that's a good one. You're hovering on it right now.
This one?
Yeah, that one right there. That's you know, that was a fun one right there. That's one of the Arctic Superconda storm clouds right there in the middle.
And, oh, okay.
You know, a lot of people will be like, oh yes, you know, you hit another gene. That albino guy sitting there was not supposed to be there.
Really?
Both parents ended up being het for albino as well, because these were virgin animals that I used to make.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so it's not any any sperm from any previous year's breedings or anything, but I had this little albino guy pop up in there, and kind of bummed me out. I didn't want to see it, but you know, it is what it is, and it's part of breeding. And I look back at my breeding notes, and I want to say, like, their great grandfather was a het albino.
Okay.
So it went all the way down through each generation, and everything lined up, and I put these two together, and I got albinos in there.
That's too. So I find that so interesting when that happens. When people get hidden hets, when it was from like a great, great grandfather or whatever, even the grandfather, and you know, the pos het just gets so tiny that like it gets written off at that point, but then you get something, you breed them together, or you breed it to another known head, and then suddenly you pop out the visuals. I always think that's so cool.
Oh yeah, it's fun. You know, I have a good friend, Scott Russell, from Boss Hogs. He made some of the first, like Arctic sable lavenders, and they came from some animals that I had given to him, and they were 25% het for sable and lavender on both parents. And he ended up hitting a home run on everything and being able to get those. So it was just incredible. Yeah, here's super Arctics, man. I love these super Arctics, man. This one right here has been a cornerstone for a lot of my projects moving forward. I love the colors that are pulling through on this.
Super Arctic. I mean, the orange on the spots here. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a hognose that kind of looks like this with the way the pattern is. Or the colors, at least.
Yeah, that's a special one for sure. And, you know, I've used that one for a lot of other things. And, you know, it's, you know, I've got, you know, I think I produce maybe about 40 or 50 super Arctics a year, and I love every single one of them. You know, you get with like real nice dashy striped patterns, and some that look different in other areas.
Yeah.
You know, they're great, you know. Lemon Ghost there. That's another one that I really like there on this right. Yeah. That's a beautiful. I got that little striped Lemon Ghost male that I work with as well. Yeah. He's a cool one. Hasn't replicated himself, but you know, it's you know, it's still a unique animal that popped out years ago. So
very cool. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I see something some of my other species there.
Yeah. No, we'll get to those. We'll wrap up on the hogs and talk about some other stuff.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, one of the things I talked about too, you got an animal right there, that one on the scale right there, 227 grams. That was one of the first ones. It might have been the first one ever produced. That's a Arctic Superconda Mai Tai. You know, okay. Superconda a lot of the times removes all pattern, but when you have Arctic that goes into it, a lot of times you get that dashing of the stripe.
Okay. Back.
So, yeah. You know, one of the things I talk about with feeding, you know, I brought it up during. I get some slack sometimes from some people, you know, if a hognose snake doesn't eat, I don't force feed it. It's going to live or die.
I'm kind of with you there, man. I agree. I've been saying it recently, like, you know, it could be the coolest Texas rat. If that thing doesn't want to eat, I'm not forcing it to.
Yeah. Like, you know, and I get slack from it, and I understand the people that say, you know, why would you let an animal die? And I'm like, well, I cater to breeders. Right. You know, I'd say 99% of my stuff that goes out is going to another breeder. There are some pet people that buy some things from me as well. But, you know, that snake in particular right there, it ate once and it did not eat again. And it went through brumation, came out of brumation, refused the first two out of brumation, looked like crap. I mean, we're talking, this thing was like 6 grams. And, one day it just started eating and never looked back. And now it's, you know, one of my larger hognose snakes that I have.
Okay.
Not my biggest, but it is something. And, you know, and going back to that, you know, I would think and I would hope that if people are force feeding their snakes and they're selling them as breeders, they would at least disclose that to people that are buying animals, that they had to force feed an animal for 3 months or 4 months or whatnot, you know. And I just don't want that in my gene pool, you know, so. Yeah.
And I forget where I was talking about it recently, and it could have been on here, but I see it a lot with the ball pythons because I work with ball pythons too. And look, I mean, there's the same way there is with the hognose. I mean, there's some big dollar animals with the ball pythons. Let's be real there. Yep. You know, you hatch a multi-thousand dollar snake and that thing's not eating, like, that's a snake you want to eat. But even still, I don't think a dollar amount is going to draw the line for me. Like, I have a $4,000 snake sitting in my rack. If that thing didn't eat, I don't know. I might try it once because, like, it would freak me out. But even still, like, I just, it's not worth it. And then, you know, there are certain genes in that segment of the industry that are known to be bad eaters, and multiple people work with this mutation that have bad eaters. And it's like, well, clearly there's something being passed down. There's a behavior being passed down to be a bad eater. So what has to happen? You guys have to draw the line somewhere and stop breeding the bad eaters.
Yeah, no, that you're absolutely right. I think, you know, it's all this different stuff. When you're playing with these genes and these snakes, that could be one of the genes, you know, a couple of them that we have in hognose snakes, you know, pink pastel. For the longest time, had neurological issues similar to like spider and ball pythons.
Okay.
They would wobble. They would crawl around on their back and things like that. Fortunately, I've never seen that in my collection, but I focus on outcrossing all animals, you know, and that's what a lot of people did with that gene for a long time. They outcrossed. And now you don't have those anomalies present. And that's because people called those animals. And same thing with the, you know, I don't know, I'm not very familiar with ball python genetics, but, you know, if there were those genes, like what you're talking about, maybe you start breeding those animals to, you know, some of those animals for like the, I don't know for sure. Maybe they're sub-Saharan ball pythons or whatnot. The big ones that get,
Boltas,
that
are, they're called Boltas.
Yeah. They're big. They eat well, you know, those type of animals. Maybe you start using those genes and getting them into that and try to erase that, you know, bad gene that's there. But, you know, I think that's where outcrossing and making sure you're, you know, bringing strong snakes into your breeding program. I think that's important. So,
yeah, 100%. you know, what you're talking about with the outcrossing is super important. I know I've talked about it with a few of the other Hognose guys I've brought on here. I know it's a important thing because when you're smushing together all these genes and probably line breeding, which involves a little bit of, you know, sibling to sibling or, you know, baby to parent or whatever, it's like you need some new blood in there to diversify it, or else you're going to start seeing problems.
Yeah. You're going to unlock problems. You know, I think, you know, I don't know, but I think, you know, hognose snakes are a little bit more sensitive to, you know, the inbreeding.
Okay.
Versus some other species. You know, I know I was, there was someone that was talking, Kayla. I think she was talking about corn snake genetics at the Kluber Fest.
That was Sarah.
Sarah. Yeah, Sarah. She was talking about the corn. And, you know, she was talking about, you know, a couple generations of inbreeding being okay with the corn snakes. And I've seen it. It works well. Hognose snakes seem to bring up problems a little bit sooner.
Okay.
You know, yes. And I'm talking direct siblings, you know, not, you know, I'm sure you can go a little bit outside that gene pool and still be acting okay. But sibling to sibling, usually F1s don't really have any problems, but you get beyond that, you start seeing problems. A lot of the problems that I see are kinking, cleft lips. That was something I saw a lot with sables, combinations when they first were coming out. I wouldn't say a lot, but I would say, you know, 1 in 80, 1 in 100, you know, would come out with a cleft lip, which was interesting to me, you know, just to have those animals like that. But, you know, it was something that definitely was happening out there. You know, like I said, I just think these guys are a little bit more sensitive, even though they probably in the wild, this probably happens quite often that they encounter a sibling or a aunt or an uncle or something like that, because they're not traveling that far after they hatch. They're not traveling like, you know, like a dry mark on, or even some of these, garter snakes and rattlesnakes and things like that. They travel. You know, they travel a pretty decent amount of distance to get to hibernation, hibernaculums and things like that. I think, you know, hognose snakes, they probably move around like the size of 2 football fields, you know, in their lifetime, I would say. You know, they're probably pretty plugged. I think there's going to be lots of good research out there on that stuff in particular. You know, we both know Zach and his team are working on some really cool things out there. So there's going to be
a lot. Yeah, I mean, that... you know, that auction at Kluberfest, I'm sure that is going to be part of the data, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely will.
That's going to be real cool.
It's going to be so cool. We did some data collection just recently at my facility.
Yeah, let me pull up that post.
Mm-hmm.
I scrolled past it at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, we brought the kids in from West Liberty, and we had a lot of good stuff that we captured, but it was, you know, 100 animals, you know, we went through. You can see what we were doing right there.
Yep.
You know, and, it's stuff that is very relevant. And what's cool, especially with this, just for my own collection to see, is it has a lot of data on growth rates, you know, inside my collection. So it would be cool to balance that off of other people's collections as well. Just to see what type of growth, because I do something a little bit unique versus a lot of the other hognose snake people out there. I brumate everything.
Okay.
So, in the winter time, since I live in the great state of Ohio, it gets cold up here, and I have the opportunity to use the weather to my advantage outside and brumate everything. So I brumate, you know,
even your hatchlings, right?
Yeah. 10 gram baby, or, you know, my biggest adults, they all go through about 10 weeks of hibernation every year. So,
yeah, you know, and even, Alvaro had mentioned that to me early, and I was like, that's actually really interesting. And I guess it does kind of get those younger animals, at least his holdbacks, obviously, it gets those animals prepared for that cycle, for when they will actually breed in a few years. And besides, if they were in the wild, they'd be experiencing it anyway.
100%.
As babies that first year, you know? So, definitely an interesting take, and probably something I'm gonna integrate going forward. And from what I could tell, I did it last year. I kept them down for, and I've talked about my brewmation. It isn't anything like, I don't get them super cold. I've done it a little bit different, but I kept mine down for a shorter period of time and kind of put them back, but just to let them fuel the cycle, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Well, piggyback on what I was talking about, I would like to see the growth rates, because I have, you know, animals that get incredibly large fast, and I really think it is because of this brumation. I feel like, you know, we use it as a trick and with the hognose snakes, and other people do it with other different colubrids and boids as well. But, you know, that cool down period almost influences these tricky babies to get eating. Well, I want to take it a step further and look at it, you know, from a different perspective as well. It may be because they're releasing different hormones and chemicals in their brain in the spring that's telling them that it's springtime and it's time okay. to eat, time to grow. And there could be a different type of chemical that is released at that point in time that tells their body all that information, and their growth pattern may be affected by it.
Interesting.
So I would like, you know, I don't have that type of bandwidth right now to understand what hormones are being released at that point in time and when. It would be good information to get, but you know, it's interesting. You know, I have, you know, snakes that have, you know, been in brumation for 10 weeks, and I've had same people, same bloodlines, everything like that, keep their snakes out, and my snakes are bigger after, you know, one
okay.
year than their snakes are. And they actually, you know, had another 10 weeks of feeding and cleaning and everything like that, and growth. So it just interests me from that perspective as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm curious about this. Do you plan on having them like come back after some time and then like redoing all this stuff on these animals, or what was the goal here? Just like kind of taking some information across a sample size?
Yes. So, and I would like to, you know, I offered this to Zach. I said, we could do this every year with students.
Yeah.
I think it's a good, nice field trip for them. He's relatively close to me. I think I want to say it's like 1.5 hours.
Oh, okay.
For the students to get to my location. So it's not bad, but we're also going to balance all this information off snakes from the wild as well. You know, we're going to be able to see, like, the only thing that's going to be different is there's going to be unknowns. Like, when did this snake hatch? You know,
right.
Was it in the fall of 2023, or was it in the spring of 2023? And, you know, there could be a dramatic difference in size at that point in time.
Right.
If you know, that's the case, but, you know, and locality, of course, with everything, but it'll be interesting to just balance some of that data off of each other.
Yeah. So, before we shift in maybe some other topics, I kind of want to talk about, you know, it, just going off of that, your relationship that you've built with Zach, because a few different things. One, you invited the students over, which is super cool. You came to Colubrid Fest, you talked at Colubrid Fest, and now you're a part of this whole book writing process with this new Hognose book. So if you want to give a little overview about the talk you gave at Colubrid Fest, I did a recap a couple weeks ago, and obviously I mentioned that you did your talk, but if you want to tell everyone what exactly it was that you kind of, you know, talked about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I brought up tricky feeders, you know, and what are some tools and techniques that we can use, not just with hognose snakes, but with any species of a snake, lizard, even turtles. I assume there would be some turtles that you could use some of these techniques with. And, you know, I spoke on a bunch of different topics, you know, subtopics inside of that. Talk about brumation, talked about ethics of you know, scenting. I talked about all, you know, broad amount of topics there to get things up and going. You know, because hognose snakes have this stigma out there for sure that they are the tricky ones. You know, I laugh about it because I don't think they're tricky. You know, I've been breeding them so long and stuff.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, this is what to expect, you know. But it's you know, it works. Some of the techniques that I use with mine work great for other species that I've worked with.
Okay.
You know? And, you know, I've worked with a few secretive species of milk snake, pale milk snakes, Eastern milk snakes,
Okay.
And all these animals, when they hatch out, they're tiny. And just getting them up and going, you know, our staple diet inside of, you know, any reptile program is mice. You know, that's our staple diet. So, a lot of the species that are worked with around the world are worked with because they favor mice. You know, there's other species, you know, that are great eaters, brilliant animals. Think about like mud snakes from the south down there by you. Amazing animals. They eat so well on salamanders, you know, but a salamander, you know, or amphibia or siren is not a readily available animal. So they're never going to be, you know, a popular animal in the trade. So just getting all these animals onto mice and what tricks and tips to get them there.
Cool. Yeah, it was a really good talk. And we mentioned it beforehand, and I was like, thank God I don't have to deal with this sometimes. But the talk you gave will absolutely come in handy the day, whenever that may come, that I may need it, because I think it's relevant for and to everyone. Whether you need it now or you need it 10 years from now, you decide to keep that one tricky species and, you know, you need to get that baby eating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's going to be other species that are just like, you know, the Western hognose snakes. You know, there's going to be that species that no one thinks about that is, you know, out there. You know, I know my employee is currently looking at Xenodon cerevis, I believe it is, out of South America. And, you know, it's an amazing species. And, you know, it has the opportunity. It comes in a bunch of different colors and things. And, you know, it would be interesting to see something like that come to the forefront and inside of, you know, another husbandry program. So, you know, it's always there and you will run into it. You know, when people say, you know, I've never had that, you will. You just haven't been keeping them long enough, you know, and it's something that will get there. And, you know, Dark Horse, I spoke with him for a while as well, since I was vending next to him. You know, he keeps a lot of very locale specific things. And, you know, I'm sure he has to use specific things to get some of those up and going. And, you know, it's just so interesting, all these different species.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Cool. And then, you know, segueing again into so, you know, he's said it a bunch of times, but you are co-authoring his hognose book that he's going to be in the process of writing, and you're mainly going to be writing from the captive husbandry and like morphs and breeding and stuff like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. I'm doing I've done a lot of writing already for this book, and you know, it's lots of pictures. You know, it's going to be another complete series. So our target here is it's going to be between 500 and 525 pages.
Wow.
So it's going to be a great amount of data and good stuff for everything heterodon, that's for sure. So, and it's not going to be just focused on westerns. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be the southerns, and it's going to be all the four complexes there of
very cool
heterodon. So I'm so excited to not only get it wrapped up. The fun part is right now getting it all together and compiling everything and you know, getting the data and just being able to share all this stuff with everyone. Because like I said before, man, we've come a long way with this species over the last 10, 12 years. You know, it was always the notorious, oh, it's a hognose snake. No one wants those because they're toad eaters. Like, no, they're not. We've come a long way with our husbandry skills. We've learned a lot. I learn something every year, you know, whether it's something small or big. And, you know, I think it'll be great to be able to pass on all that knowledge to the future keepers. So,
yeah, there's something, I don't mean to sound cliche. I feel like there's something magical about like reptile books. It's something like the good ones and like all those, like the complete series and any, good ones. Like I have the book that Zach wrote, the first one, the Dipsatid book. I have the Klaus collection of papers, like the Asian rat snakes one. It's like when you open those and you read some of the content in there, you're just like, wow, there's so much information here. And I think it's so cool. And I like adding things to my library. And, you know, I like to absorb all different types of reptile content, like the complete reticulated python just got released recently and yep. people are going crazy over that. And from what I've heard, it's absolutely packed with information. So I can't wait to see what you and Zach put together as the final product. And I will definitely be purchasing it.
Yeah, we got some good stuff that we're putting in there. You know, we
and that's coming from me as not a hognose person. I will absolutely buy it. So
yeah, that's cool. Well, thanks, man. We brought it together and we had some really good ideas and thought outside the box on this. It's going to be a unique complete series book, but it's going to be it's going to be wonderful. I mean, I'm hoping for the best one. I remember, you know, I was on my honeymoon back in 2007, and what did I bring to read on the beach at the honeymoon? It was the complete boa constrictor.
Okay.
So, you know, that's what I read on the beach, you know, when I was down on my honeymoon. So I get it, man. And, you know, you said you're a fan of the library and stuff, you know, me too. I bring it over here.
Nice.
You know, it's just, you know, bookshelves with all these different, you know, these are all reptile books in my life.
I need to get more. I'm definitely it's getting started. I have a few good ones I feel like to start off with. And I definitely need to add more to my collection.
Yeah. That Klaus book that you're talking about, you know, I'm a fan of, you know, some of the Asian rat snakes, and that is a brilliant book that he put together.
So I have the second one, the collection of papers. I want the original monograph. Someone posted it on Facebook last week for $300. And I said, oh, Jesus Christ. I'm like, it's 300. And then I was like, I sent it to this chat and Zach was like, this is herp history. You may never be able to get, like, you can't get this again. And I said, fine. And I sent the guy a message and he responded in the morning, it's sold already. I was like,
God, yeah, I've got two books from him.
Yeah, there's the two.
Yeah, I've got the one, I think it's in like Dutch or German.
Okay.
I've got that one. And then I got the one that you're speaking of. I got that. And they're both signed by him as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to get some signed copies of those. And, you know, that's, you know, he died, unfortunately, like 7 years ago, something like that. It might have been a little sooner than that. But so I was happy to get those for my collection. But great books. Like,
yeah, I was able to pick up the collection of papers. It was earlier this year. I randomly went to some online site and there was one available. I was like, yes. And I bought it and I was like, okay, it came in a fantastic condition. You know, that book was written in, like, they don't print them anymore. It wasn't brand new, but like it was in real nice condition. So
no, and that stuff's important. You know, he did the real work.
Oh,
with those species right there. You know, it's Dwight Plott did it as well for the Western hognose snakes. He did a paper for the University of Kansas. I want to say it was like 1963 or 64. And I mean, broke it down from everything, like clutch sizes of snakes from certain regions, what their hatch rates were, how many days, gut contents of everything, you know, and breaking that down and what the theories behind that are. You know, I mean, they were talking about gut contents of Western hognose snakes having like beetle larvae and stuff in there and some small Western hognose snakes. So then it gets your mind working. You're like, all right, you know, these guys are like garbage disposals anyway. They feel like at some points they eat like the good eaters are good eaters. They'll like eat anything. You know, you put Cheerios in front of them, you know, if they're on feeding mode, they might eat them. But, you know, it makes you think like, what are these beetles? Were they actually a prey item or were they a prey item of their prey? You know, that's where more where I was thinking, maybe the frogs or toads that they're eating, that was the best content of those. But, you know, it just makes your brain work. And that's, you know, it's cool to be able to think outside the box on things like that. So,
yeah, definitely, man. Cool. Any last regards about hognose? I feel like there's so much stuff to talk about and we could probably dive down rabbit holes, but anything else you want to cover?
The future is bright on these guys, man.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's getting to that point now to where there's so many more people. And, you know, I spoke about it, during the Kluberd Fest. what I love seeing the most is people brand new to the hobby getting into the species that I love, the Western hognose snakes,
yep,
and then teaching me something. I love it because the new guys haven't been brainwashed from everything that they've read online or things like that. I try to tell people, use critical thinking and think outside the box. Take everything that you know you think you should know about a hognose snake and throw it out the window, and use your mind on where they come from, how the husbandry is that you think they should be since they come from that region, and implement it into your program. And I think we're going to see a lot of things happen over the next 20 years, 25 years or so with husbandry and this species in general. So I'm just excited. I'm here for it. You know, even if I get to a point in my life where I'm just more of a herpetologist more than a herpetoculturist, I'll be watching closely and seeing what people do with this species.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, like we've said, you know, the hognose have absolutely just exploded over the last, I don't know, what's it been, like 6-7 years, even a little bit more than that. I mean, and then the morphs, like, and, you know, like we get reminded with every CCR episode, hognose are the most populated colubrid on morph market. I mean, that speaks volumes, because if you look back, I don't know, 5 years ago, that was nowhere near the case, I assume.
Yeah, no, not absolutely not. I remember when the original owner of Morph Market, his name was John. And he was like, "Hey, man, I'd love to have your business on my page, you know." And we worked with each other for a while, and you know, helped get Morph Market off the ground back then. But you know, Darian has done some amazing things with that platform since. I'm honestly blown away when he first took over Morph Market. I was kind of skeptical because I like John. Me and him talked. We were on a first name basis. We're both Johns.
Yeah.
You know, everything was great, you know. And I was like, ah, man, you know, here comes this guy, you know. But I am highly impressed with what he's done with Morph Market, and he's just propelled it. I mean, I'm a 100%. kingsnake.com and a fauna classifieds guy, you know, from back in the day, and everything like that. And I was like, nothing can be like that. Morph Market is, you know, it's up there. It's top tier. He's done a great job. So
yeah, definitely, man.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Now talk about some other species. You mentioned you had some others. I thought I saw an Asian rat snake when I scrolled through there. What else are you working with?
So I do, I said some earlier, I do the pale milk snakes.
Yeah.
I have some rosy boas. But as far as Japanese rat snakes go, I have Japanese forest rat snakes, which I really like those, the conspix. I have the Bella chapensis, the choppus rat snakes.
Okay.
Love those. Very cool snakes. And then I also have axanthic mandarin rat snakes.
Very nice.
So, yeah, those are mother species. And my daughter has quite the exquisite corn snake collection.
Okay.
You know, she'll be 11 coming up here this coming weekend, or what, 2 weekends from now. You know, she has a huge corn snake collection, some top notch stuff. It's funny, you know, a lot of my friends found out my daughter was getting into corn snakes, and all of a sudden I started receiving all these boxes on my front porch. You know, I had to tell them all at one point, like, stop sending boxes of snakes to my daughter. Like, she loves them. Everything's great. But, you know, at one point, you know, you're going to fill up my snake facility with just corn snakes, and I breed hognose snakes. So,
cool though, man. Yep. I mean, having your kid be into it too, because I feel like it's like they're like one way or another. It's like they either just don't care, or like they're indifferent to it, or like they love it as much as you do. And you know, hearing that, you know, your daughter is just as into it, that's so cool. And giving it to the next generation, that's the most important thing. You know, I was saying earlier, like the guy I sold the Texas rat to, I mean, he had his young daughter there. And while it seemed like he was a bit more interested in the snake than his daughter was, but like maybe she'll grow to like it seeing her dad have fun with it. So
Oh, yeah,
that's important to me.
Oh, yeah. No, it's It's very important to me. But besides that, I do, that's on the snake side. I think that's all. I have some really cool garter snakes as well. They're just display animals, but, that's on the snake side. On lizard side, I have, Eurydactylus geckos, the finger geckos. I have chihuahuas. I'm very successful with both of those. They lay eggs more than I want.
Chihuahuas are real cool, man. I take a liking to those.
Yeah, I have those. And then I have a nice little group of Gila monsters as well.
Oh, nice.
They're so fun. I mean, amazing animals. A lot of the species that I look at, if they're going to be kept in my facility as breeders, I have to keep species that can get cold. So all of these animals that I have, I mean, last year, my facility for a few days got down to 28 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was cold in there. There was water, or the water bowls were frozen for those days. And it is something that I have to be able, and all the species of snake that I mentioned got that cold and did fine. Nice. So that is something that I focus on. If I keep something that needs to be a little bit warmer, they stay inside on display. Okay. Like the chihuahuas, the Eurydactylus geckos, the Gila monsters, I like get cold. They're not a species that I worry about, but, I do those. And then I, keep some turtles as well. I nice. Have Mississippi map turtles, a couple different color mutations of those. I got the chocolates and some head albinos. So hopefully I'll be producing some visual albinos, which from what I understand, those are very rare. And then I have some diamondback terrapins, some ornate mangrove and concentric diamondback terrapins. And what else do I have? Some Florida red bellies. About every single color mutation of those things. So they're pretty cool. Nice. So yeah.
Awesome, man. I do want to go back to the Choppa and the Conspix a little bit. Have you bred those guys? Those are a couple species I haven't talked about on here really at all, I think.
No, I haven't bred them. I attempted to breed the Chapensis this year. Kind of watched them to see what was going on. They locked up, everything looked great, didn't get any eggs, not really concerned. I just thought they were pretty. But I'm going to be focusing a little bit more on those next year. They're a lot like racers, man. I know a lot of people say that those, you know, when you think of rat snake, you know, for me and you, we think of corn snake, Texas rat snake,
right,
things of that structure. All of these Japanese species are very racer like. Their heads are.
Yeah, and I work with the Porphyracea, which are would be in that racer kind of category as well. 100%. So
they're classified as a rat snake as well.
Yes. You know,
so, I mean, but they do have that very, very racer like head, and you can tell they're a fossorial species. Like, they're definitely in the forest floor. That's where those guys are definitely hanging out at. They're not up in a tree or anything. You know, I treat them a lot like I would a racer. They're very bitey. It seems like everything, you know, with those guys. The Chapensis are not so much, but the Japanese forest rat snakes, very shy.
Okay.
You know, they're very shy animals, you know, but keep them cool. That's what I do. I keep them on the lower parts of my Freedom Breeder racks, and I have all the heat removed from them, you know.
That's how I roll, too, on my Asian stuff.
Yeah, but a wonderful species. You know, I've really had a good time raising them up and having fun with them. So
that's awesome. And having the Azanthic mandarin, the mandarin rat snakes. I mean, that's not something a lot of people have. Those Azanthics are absolutely beautiful.
Oh yeah, and what's so interesting about those is, you know, when they hatch out, they look like a real intense high yellow.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
Mandarin rat snake. It almost it reminds me almost of like super Arctic how you know they hatch and they're almost solid black, and then they turn into these black and white magnificent animals.
Right.
It's almost the same thing with these Exanthic mandarin rat snakes. You know, they progressively get you know, more and more washed out in black and white, and you know, they're beautiful. I mean, they're beautiful.
It's the contrast that does it to me, because even though, you know, you have the white like base color, those blacks are so sharp and so like super nice. Like I'm a sucker for contrast on snakes, so they really got it good.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I think that's why a lot of people, you know, there's so many fans of Superconda and the Hognose Snake, and but I'm a pattern guy, you know.
Yeah, that, I like,
you know. So I'm like,
I'm kind of with you there. Yeah, Supercondas aren't my favorite, though. I agreed with I agree what you said about the kind of stripey ones, the ones that get the that middle stripe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When you have some other color mutations that influence that, I think it improves them. But, you know, I'm like you. I like the contrast. So that's what really pulled me to those Xanthic Mandarin rat snakes was, you know, number one, I always wanted to work with Mandarin rat snakes. I thought they were fun. I wanted to check that box. And, you know, it was something that I just had to have at one point. Same thing with the Conspix, the Japanese forest rat snakes. From the first time that I saw them described, I was like, I want to have this species of snake.
Yeah.
You know, and so I did lots of research and acquired them. And, you know, it was fun. So
nice.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome, man. So yeah, that's really all I got. Just a few wrap up questions that I like to go into. What's a big motivator for what keeps you going with the reptiles in general, the reptile hobby? I mean, you know, we see a lot of negative things online, people getting out, the economy is bad, all this stuff. But what is it that keeps your head, you know, focused and driven?
Me, it's never so for me, it's never been about the money.
Yeah,
I think that's the thing I tell people a lot when they get into it. They're like, well, how much money can I make? I'm like, go do something else. Like,
yep.
if you're in it just for the money, you know, it will come if you love something enough.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what it is, you know, I can see you doing it. You're building a wonderful platform, Joe. And,
thank you.
What you're putting out there for the rest of the reptile community. This is what we need. So I would say that, I never look at it from that. I'm always just looking forward in the care of the animals. I have fun every single second that I'm out there in the snake building. When I'm out there, it's my safe place. If I'm having a rough day or if I'm feeling a certain way or something, I can go out there and get lost in the racks and just feel so much better, you know?
Oh yeah.
One of the things that keeps me going as well is I just want to educate. That's it. I want to teach people about these. I want to show them that, you know, they're not some of my friends use the devil serpents, you know, that used to, like, they just want to bite and kill everything. These are amazing animals. They're amazing pets for people, especially people that can't have other pets like cats or dogs.
Yeah.
They're allergic or something like that. This is a great opportunity for these people to be able to connect with nature and really do something positive. So that's what keeps me motivated, man. I want to teach people and I just want to share my success and stories. And I tell people all the time, there's never a stupid question, and learn from my mistakes because I've fallen on my face many times.
Oh yeah.
And you know, that's just that right there.
Yeah, definitely. I share a similar mindset. I'm all about teaching other people. Like, you know, like I said, it's all about the bringing it back full circle. Inspiring other people to like them the same way I do, you know?
Now, Joe, let me ask you a question. What's, sure. Can you give me a time when you've fallen on your face and scratched your head a little bit? And what did you learn?
With the reptiles, mm-hmm. You know what? I jumped into a ton of ball pythons. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in starting this podcast and like really absorbing a lot of colubrid content and seeing what other people had, getting into being able to actually see more of the colubrid world, I realized that I made a mistake and I wasn't as passionate about the ball pythons. And that was a little more of the selfish, like, oh, I can maybe make some money doing this. And now I've begun reducing that collection, and I've talked about it a bunch. I've begun reducing that collection to a project I actually really do like, and I am really focused on. And now I'm getting to have more fun with a lot more colubrid species, and some of which I never thought I'd own because I thought they were too difficult. Like, you know, if you asked me 5 years ago, I could never keep a rhino rat snake, but here I am with two of them and I absolutely love them.
Yeah.
Like, so cool. Like,
did you get them as babies? Did you have to feed them fish?
No, I bought one as it was a 2021. I bought it earlier this year. And then I did get a 23 hatchling. Most people these days, the Rhino Wrap breeders have been getting them on pinkies like before even selling them. So I didn't have that issue.
Yeah, cool.
Nah. I know the day I have to breed them and hopefully hatch them myself, I know I'll have to deal with the pinky stuff. The fish stuff, but I'm willing to put that work in.
Oh, it's no big deal. You know, you're going to have fun with it and you'll be successful. I know you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to say there's that guy, what is it? Anarchy Colubrids or something like that. He's keeping some of those outside and doing some wonderful work with it, with those things. He's either doing those or Barons.
I think it's the Barons with Anarchy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He's got the Barons.
Yeah. That he's doing, but, you know, what, you know, he's another one thinking outside the box and keeping things, you know, he's keeping things outside. Oh, yeah. You know, Ron St. Pierre's done some groundbreaking work with some species down there. And, you know, I think there's going to be a lot more. Like I said, in 25 years, we're going to look back and be like, man, we learned a lot, you know?
Yeah.
That's for sure.
You know, looking back at it now, where we were 10 years ago in the hobby, and like you know you can only imagine what it's going to be like in 20 more years, like where we could possibly be.
Like I remember when I first got into them, I had I had some beautiful hand built slide glass front enclosures, but you know, when I was 11 years old, there were no like Helix thermostats or anything like that. And I remember getting my first Helix and stuff, but I literally had light bulbs with dimmers, you know, that
okay.
them to like heat the cages and different stuff like that. And wow. Where we've come, that's for sure.
Yeah. Definitely, man. Cool. So what does the future for Fathom Hogs look like? If you want to put like a 3 to 5 year timeline on it, what would you say? Is it kind of like keeping the train rolling? Is it anything new and exciting on the horizon? What would you say?
Oh yeah, no, we're definitely keeping the train rolling. We are working with some other species. We're working with, you know, the tricolor hognose snakes.
Nice.
We've got every species except the black tree monitors. So we have the cordensis, the yellows, really? The greens, the blues. Oh, we have all of those adults now. We're
That's
keeping
legit.
Those. Yeah, we're keeping those down at Mitch's house in Naples. So, nice. We have, you know, those are going to be really fun to work with. The Gila monsters. I mean, we're not stopping. You know, this is we're diversifying with some other species. And it's not because of any one specific reason or another. You know, you brought up the economy and, everyone's screaming, doing this, that doesn't even matter to us. We're just doing what we love. And, that's what's, I think, the most important thing is that I'd love to incorporate my kids into this a little bit more and get them on there doing some more things. They currently come to shows with me and things like that, but I would love to really build a brand for them and get them moving forward as well. So, yeah.
Hell yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. And then bringing it full circle back to, you know, what this was about, to the hognose, what would you say to someone looking to get into the hognose species, whether they're a snake keeper or whether it's a first time keeper? What's your elevator pitch for hognose snakes?
Hognose snake. It's the best pet snake out there. No, I would tell them do their research. I would say, the most important thing is to come into this space and know what your expectations are, what you want out of the species itself. You know, I tell a lot of people, you know, if you want a pet rock, you can get a pet rock in the reptile world. But if you want a snake that is diurnal, wants to come out and interact with you on a daily basis, whether it's at your desk or in your room, hognose snake is the perfect animal.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Mm-hmm. Well, that was fantastic. It's been a great hour and 25 minutes. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was a really good episode. You're super informative, and I appreciate it. But yeah, what do you have to say to everyone who watched the live show and anyone else who's going to watch or listen to the replay?
Oh, man. Get out there and get a hog nose snake. No, I would say just what I would want to say to everyone is think outside the box. Use critical thinking when you're keeping these animals, and you're going to be able to give more to this community doing that than you know. So I preach that to everyone. Use your brain, and man, the future is bright with all of herpetoculture. So yeah. I'm super excited to see where this goes. And you know, there's someone out there that's listening to this right now that is going to be that next Brian Barcheck, that next, you know, Fathom Hogs, that next, you know, whoever it could be, you know, yeah. There's that next person. They are going to watch this episode. And, you know, that's the minds that we've got to inspire.
So, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely, man. Good message to leave on. Well, fantastic. Well, again, John, thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to throw you backstage. If you want to hang out for a couple minutes, I'm just going to run the outro and we'll talk after. But sounds thank great. You, man.
Great thanks, episode. Joe. Thanks, everybody.
No problem. All right, guys. What another fantastic episode of the Kluber Corruption podcast with John of Fathom Hogs. Really informative. John's a cool guy. And if I may have forgotten to mention it. We like connected at Kluber Fest. That's where we met. You know, we both did the talks. We were kind of vending like behind one another. So that was cool. But yeah, guys, if you enjoyed tonight's episode, please, like I've said, feel free to leave a like. Make sure you hit subscribe. Leave a comment if you're listening to this after. Let us know what your favorite part of the episode was. Start doing that. And if you're listening on the audio platforms, come over to YouTube. Hit that subscribe. We're getting close to that 1,000 subscribers. I forgot to say we're at 977 now. We're getting close. So come on over. Do that. Yeah, guys, and make sure you follow John on Instagram at shovelnose82. Yeah, at shovelnose82. Go follow him there. The link's in the description. But yeah, guys, what another great episode of the Kluber Corruption podcast. This was episode number 41 with John Rice of Fathom Hogs. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I hope you all have a fantastic night, day, afternoon, whenever you're listening to this. But peace out. See you next week.